form. This expresses the entire purpose of this course. So this is written by Govinda Das Kaviraj, a great Vaishnava poet of the what we call the Middle Ages. And he writes, "O mind," this is he's addressing his own mind, "as a separate personality." And we're going to show you how true that is. So, "O mind, just worship the lotus feet of the son of Nanda, which makes one fearless. Having obtained this rare human birth, cross over this ocean of worldly existence by associating with saintly persons. Day and night I remain sleepless, suffering heat and cold, wind and rain, for a bit of flickering happiness, chapalasukha. I have vainly served wicked and miserly men. What assurance of real happiness is there in all one's wealth, youth, sons, and relatives? This life totters like a drop of water on a lotus petal. Therefore, you should always worship the lotus feet of Lord Hari. Govindadas longs to hear the glories of Lord Hari, chant his glories. Constantly remember him, offer him prayers, serve his lotus feet, become his servant, worship him, serve him as a friend, and completely offer him his very self." So, as you can see from the blackboard, this course is called the Bhagavata Science of the Mind. The word science is a translation of the Sanskrit tattva. So, many of you have attended our Srimad Bhagavatam course that we began to offer here for 4 days a week in December. And we told you about this class, and we told you that in this class, we are not going to, or put it this way, we're going to take off the gloves when it comes to tattva. We're going to go very deep into the subject matter of the mind, what it is, how it works the way it works, why it gives us so much trouble, and how we can be free of the trouble. Actually, we can never be free of the mind. This is the first thing. First very important point. If you're taking notes, you should write that down. That's impersonalism. To think that there'll be a day when I will have no mind, and I'm saying this because I've actually heard this sort of thing preached sometimes in classes in ISKCON. I found this very remarkable. But actually, this is impersonalism. Why is that? Because even in the material world, you find in the fifth canto, that the mind is ruled by Soma, or the moon, the god of the moon, and behind him stands Aniruddha. And Soma is the lord of rasa in the material world. So that means we taste the material rasa through the mind. And through the purified mind, we taste transcendental rasa. So those who talk about negating the mind, ridding the mind altogether, going, as I heard in one lecture, directly from intellect, buddhi, to indriya, intelligence, bypassing the mind altogether, who needs the mind, kick it out. This is actually impersonalism. This is dry. This is, I call this the male disease, you see. Male intellectuals have a tendency to this form of extremism. And then later on, they end up in very embarrassing circumstances. Because, as the Bhagavatam says, every one of us, whether you're sannyasi or grihastha or man or even woman, every one of us has 11 wives. Actually, we have one wife, the mind, and she has her 10 attendants. Therefore, you see here in Bengal so often the depictions of Durga Devi Shakti as a woman with 10 arms. So the mind is feminine. The mind is Chanchala, which is actually the name of Goddess Fortune. She's flickering, she's unsteady, she goes through phases. And her 10 arms are the 5 karmendriyas, or working senses, and 5 gyanendriyas, or knowledge acquiring senses. And every one of us, whether you're wearing saffron or whatever you're wearing, you're married to a 10-armed woman. Even if you're wearing a sari. You're in a marriage and there's no divorce. There's no divorce whatsoever. No possibility of divorce. You've got that mind. Therefore, we start in our introduction that there's a Bengali saying to the effect that wherever one may travel in this world seeking to flee old problems and start a new life, one must bring one's mind along with him. Sometimes we try this, you know. We've gotten into trouble somewhere, you know, difficulties with just certain devotees, relationships that we can't break out of. It's just problem. So I'll go to some promised land. It's amusing how many Western devotees think India is the promised land and how many Indian devotees think America, particularly America, is the promised land for them. They can't wait till they get the green card to get the hell out of here. Meanwhile, in the West, the devotees are so anxious. But actually, India is the best place to come to terms with this problematic mind because this is the Punya Bhumi, particularly holy places like Sridham Mayapur and Vrindavan Dham. So, yes, we have to learn what this mind is and how to bring the mind under control, how to make the mind chaste, how to make the mind our friend. That's what Krishna says in Gita. The mind can be your best friend. Imagine if your mind was just as eager to hear and chant and remember and just be absorbed in Krishna as it now is eager for sense gratification. What a friend that would be. If you had a mind that just when you heard the name Krishna would rush. Oh, I want to go there. I want to, Krishna, where are you? That's like the mind of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And this is Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's movement. We are all devotees only by his blessings. And his full blessings is this type of mind. Where when he saw at Puri, a sand dune hill, and this appeared to his mind as Govardhan. This is actually called Divyon Mada, divine madness. It's crazy. In a sense, yes, it's crazy. If your mind is hallucinating, you see, if you see a sand mound as a mountain, that would be considered craziness. But in Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, this is the perfection. And we should all be anxious, eager to be blessed by little drops of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's madness, that they may fall into our mind, so that our mind may also become so easily overwhelmed by Krishna consciousness, you see, by the stimulants of remembrance and love of Krishna. So that is the real Manasi Yoga, the yoga of the mind, that bhakti offers us, not annihilation of the mind so that there's only buddhi. So that's jnana yoga, you see. That's and as I say, that's what I often think of as particularly the male disease. Ladies, especially the humble, more humble ones, they often admit they're mental. And they may lament that that's a bad qualification. But if you know how to deal with your mind, it's not a bad qualification at all. We're all mental, actually. And we should begin by admitting it. I like to give this example from the history of philosophy of one Arthur Schopenhauer, who among European philosophers was the really hardcore, hard-hearted. If you see his picture, you wince, you know. He's a German and he's got this disgusted look on his face all the time, because he was a philosopher, a European philosopher, one of the first to be really influenced by Buddhism. So Buddhism is Shunyavad, voidism. So he was really into this voidistic, you know, life is, as they would say in German, Scheiße, you know. I won't translate that, but if you know German, you know what I just said. Das Leben ist nur Scheiße, you see. So, and therefore, we just have to negate it, get rid of it, throw it out. throughout life and throughout the mind, and he just wanted to be a pure intellectual. But he was a very angry and frustrated person. And he lived in an apartment building, and he had a neighbor, a woman, an old woman who was kind of nosy. And whenever he would come out of his apartment, her door would crack open and she would look out. What are you doing? So finally he got so disturbed by her, you know, doing this, that one day he just reached in through the door and pulled her out and threw her down the stairs. And she was seriously injured. And so the court concluded that he had to pay her life support for the rest of her days. And so out of the earnings, he was, you know, he used to furiously write all these books full of negativity towards, you know, hatred towards the world. And he was one of the first European philosophers to actually use the word Maya, you know, everything is just Maya, illusion. And so this was his mood. And it was, as I said, really expressed on his face. And then in the notes of one of his manuscripts, he was writing one of his books, and in the notes of the manuscript, as he was writing, he received news that this woman had finally died. So then he put in the margin, "The bitch is dead." So, you know, this is the typical, you know, ultra-masculine, you know, ultra-booty. But you can actually see that although he was trying to be purely abstract, intellectual, you know, pure logic, his whole thing is about emotions, just total negative anger, frustration. He was totally under the control of his mind, you see. Just the darkest aspects of the mind. And so that's what happens. Someone who wants to be so intellectual just becomes fascinated with the vikalpa function of the mind, which is rejection. The mind has two basic functions. Sankalpa, accepting things as nice, especially if you're in material consciousness, those things that please the senses, oh, that's very nice. Very nice music, you see. Very nice looking girl, very nice day. And then things that the senses repulse the senses, then the mind puts in the category of not nice. So one who tries to be a pure intellectual, that's generally where they end up, just in the vikalpa part of the mind. That everything is, all this is scheisse. See, everything is just, that's untranslatable. So, we want to begin with an introduction to this subject that will not immediately take us into the depths of tattva, but just to talk about the mind, what it is, that it is a very real thing. You see, the good news is that it's not us. You see, that's the good news. It's not us. But as I said, we can never get rid of it. Why? Because it is the energy of Lord Aniruddha. And Lord Aniruddha is an expansion of the Chaturvyuha, the four forms of the Lord that expand for the purpose of creation, starting with Vasudeva, who is in transcendence, then Sankarshan, then Pradumna, then Aniruddha. And Aniruddha is, the mind is his energy. And Aniruddha's feature within us, the feature of him that is within each of us, is the Paramatma, or Supersoul. And he's the Manomaya in the language of Vedanta Sutra, the Lord of the mind, the ruler of the mind. So the shape of our mind, the shape our mind is in, is very indicative of our relationship with the Lord. You see, I remember hearing a lecture by Srila Prabhupada. He said, if you are feeling sad, depressed, unhappy, you see, morose, that means you're in Maya. Because the Lord is Anandamaya Purusha. He is that person whose very form is of bliss. Anandamaya. Like the sun is called Jyotirmaya. Jyotirmaya means full of effulgence. You see, you can't look at the sun because it is so bright. It's the nature of the sun. In the sense, Maya means nature of. So Jyotirmaya, the nature of the sun is to be full of light, full of brilliance, blindingly so. So the Lord is Anandamaya. He's just streaming bliss from his very form. His form is bliss and the bliss streams off of him. So if you are Krishna conscious, if a devotee is Krishna conscious, then he's blissful. He simply shares in the blissful nature of the Lord. And if we're obsessed with our problems and, you know, our clouded thoughts of, you know, how terrible we are and terrible people are around us and how many bad things have happened to us and this and that, negativity, negativity. Prabhupada said that means we're in Maya. So the mind is sort of like, you know, a speedometer in a car. You need a speedometer to know how fast you're going, otherwise you're breaking the law, you see. If your speedometer doesn't work and you're driving, then, you know, and you can say, I didn't know, officer, my speedometer doesn't work. Well, sorry, you still get a ticket for speeding. So the mind is very useful in that way. We can judge our Krishna consciousness by the shape of our mind, by how much our mind is attracted to Krishna. How much bliss, how much transcendental happiness we're experiencing in the mind. So the mind is a very real thing. So there are some essential points I put down here. Five essential points. These are essences of the whole course. Having accepted that the mind is a real thing, counted, listed in Bhagavad Gita as one of the eight elements of the Lord's creation. And although it is subtle, it has real substance. So here's two quotations by Srila Prabhupada. Since the mind is a product of the mode of goodness, if it is fixed upon the Lord of the mind, Aniruddha, then the mind can be changed to Krishna consciousness. Listen to this. The mind can be changed to Krishna consciousness. Do you get the full impact of what the Prabhupada is saying here? We talk about Krishna consciousness. We talk about the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. In a sense, we're talking about the International Society of the Mind. The pure mind. Nothing else than that. You see? The pure state of the mind. That is what the society is meant to bring about. So, it is stated by Narottam Das Thakur that we always have desires. Because, this is another point, that the locus of our desires are the mind. That's why the mind is the chief of the senses. The senses act out our desires, but where are the desires coming from? They're coming from the mind. They're even coming from us, we'll get into that, a place beyond our conscious mind. You see, we're only, when we talk of the mind, generally we mean what we're aware of. But the mind goes much deeper than that, but that's for later. So the mind comes from that deeper part, which Prabhupada called the subconscious. But anyway, that is also the mind. But if we continuing with this quotation, but if we transfer our desires to please the Supreme Personality of Godhead, that is the perfection of life. As soon as the desire is transferred to lording it over material nature, it becomes contaminated by matter. This is from the purport of Srimad Bhagavatam 3:26, verse 31. So, point number one that I want to make in this introduction. The essential point is that the mind, which is contaminated by material attraction, has to be bridled. It has to be brought under control and concentrated upon the Supreme Personality of Godhead. That was another quote by Srila Prabhupada. That was not the first point. That was the second quote. I'll read it again. The essential point, there's two things here. That the mind which is contaminated by material attraction has to be bridled and it has to be concentrated upon the Supreme Personality of Godhead. This is from Bhagavatam 3rd Canon, chapter 28, verse 7, purport. Okay, so then in these two quotations, there are five basic points that I'm bringing out, and these five basic points are the foundation of the whole class that we'll be giving. And there's no clear cut-off date of this class. As I indicate here, you can go up to the Gaur Purnima Parikram start, or Gaur Mandala Bhumi Parikram, and then there's 5 days of seminars after that, and we can continue this then too, because we have a lot of material, including a film. Don't go away. In half an hour, you're going to be going upstairs to see a film. So, please stay for that. You'll find this film very interesting. If anything, it's going to overturn your whole perception of perception. So, there's 5 points that I want to make. And then Nitai Gorasundar, I have to introduce. He'll speak about himself when he talks, but he is our resident, for now anyway, psychologist. At least he has a Bachelor of Arts degree in psychology from the University of Massachusetts, is it? Yes. Mm-hmm. So he is our Western psychological professional here, who has even worked in psychiatric institutions and has very many interesting, bizarre tales to tell about what happens when the mind goes completely out of control. So he'll be entertaining you with such stories. So, but these are the 5 essential points of the whole course. So number 1 is that the essential substance of the mind is the mode of goodness, which is the energy of Lord Aniruddha, who is the localized supersoul feature of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Number 2, when that sattvic mental substance is dedicated to the Lord, it is transformed to Krishna consciousness, the state of infallible goodness above the 3 modes of material nature. That's called Turiya, or Vishuddha Sattva, or Vasudev Sattva, transcendence. And so that is the constitutional position of the jiva. That's the jiva in his own glory, as we sometimes read in Prabhupada's translations. The jiva in his own glory. The pure mode of goodness, which means, you see, the material mode of goodness means it is impregnated with rajogun, tamogun. Just like, there's that old joke, which we used to, it's acceptable. It's not really a dirty joke, but it you know, leans in that direction. But it's an acceptable joke. And it's a joke of the father of a teenage girl who hears a rumor that his daughter, whom he was very proud of being so chaste and virginal, is actually pregnant. So this disturbs him very much. So she comes home from school, and he sits her down and he says, dear, I need to know the truth. Are you pregnant? And her face goes red and she looks down and she says, just a little bit, daddy. So just a little bit pregnant, you know, means in 4 or 5 months you're going to be a lot pregnant. 6, 7 months. So similarly, to be just a little bit in my, in the mode of goodness with just a little tinge of rajagun tamagun means in time rajagun tamagun are going to become very obvious. Just like when a woman is 8, 9 months pregnant, it's very obvious, you see. So that's not good enough for Krishna consciousness. So the next point is that point three, to dedicate the mind to the Lord, we must channel the flow of our desires towards His lotus feet. Hence, this is very important. I want you to get this point. Because this may sound to you to be my, like, oh, now he's introducing some personal bias, but I have really prepared this course and I am going to show you how this is really what Prabhupada is saying in his books. Hence, there is no question of controlling the mind in that, as I say, very masculine yogic, I'm going to take charge here sense. There's no question of that. The mind cannot be controlled in that way. It cannot be fixed in that way. It cannot be pacified in that way simply by our own strength. Desire has to be reformed. Then the mind can be controlled. Our quality of mind is subject to the quality of our desires. So that's where we start. The project of controlling the mind is not, as I told in the morning Bhagavatam class about a bhakta. I heard about this bhakta from Vishnu Janamaraj, who was a very beloved, as I always like to say, he was the one person who taught me the meaning of the word God brother. You see, and I always so fondly remember him. So he told me this story of when in Los Angeles of a bhakta who had a harmonica holder that he used to wear around his neck. Instead of harmonica, he had a picture of Krishna. And so he'd walk around the temple with this picture of Krishna always in front of his face, wash the pots, everything. And, you know, this was his idea of always remembering Krishna, never forgetting him. And as Vishnu Janamaya said, he didn't last very long. So there's no question of, even in that way, by keeping a picture of Krishna in front of your face at 24 hours a day, of controlling the mind without reforming desire. You see? Without addressing our desires. If your mind is full of desires, you can put, there's so many examples we can give from India, you know, pictures of Krishna everywhere, deities of Krishna everywhere, Rasleela murals here and there and everywhere, and yet what's going on in the place is sinful activities. The Prakriti Sahajas perfect this, you see. Because they're not in control of the desires, and they just have some philosophy to shrug all that off and say, you know, we are Krishna's devotees. So then from the logic of the above point two, and to read point two was, when the sattvic mental subject is dedicated to the Lord, it is transformed to Krishna consciousness. So from that logic, it's clear that the original condition of the mind is Krishna consciousness. You see? So it's not that we want to rid ourselves of the mind, to blow it up or to dissolve it in acid or something like that, or leave it behind, you know, lock it up in a closet and throw away the key. Our original state as Krishna conscious, Jivera Swarupoy Nichara Krishna Das, is the state of the purified. In a sense, we can say it's the mind that defines the jiva. It's our mind that defines us as jivas. Of course, Krishna has his mind too, but that is infallible. Infallible and unfathomable. So, that original condition of the mind is contaminated as soon as our desire flows towards lording it over matter. And then the fifth point is that which we know to be the material mind, that which we call our mind at present time, is simply in essence the condition of material attraction. That sums up what the mind is. It is our state of being attracted to matter, gross or subtle, however it is, but one who is attracted to matter then has a material mind. And one who is attracted only to Krishna then has a spiritual mind. But there must be a mind. Because we are jivas, we must be attracted to something. We can never be independent. This is why Madhvacharya, he makes this interesting point, that the soul is always, you see, we in our Vaishnava vocabulary, we have these terms, Nitya Bada and Nitya Siddha. You know, there are devotees, we say there are living entities who are Nitya Siddha, eternally liberated, and those who are Nitya Bada, eternally conditioned. Well, Sripad Madhvacharya, he says, actually, every soul, whether here in the material world or there in the spiritual world, is nityavada, is bound. But it's a question of bound to what? Those there are bound to Krishna. Those here are bound to Maya. But everyone, if you're a jiva, you're bound to something. And what are you bound by? The mind. And that's what makes us jivas. So this is what I really wanted to establish, that there's no question of negating the mind. And that type of preaching has been actually very damaging in the past. And very misleading. So we want to correct that. That there definitely very much is a place for psychology in Krishna consciousness. But what we want to do in this course is show you that the Bhagavatam is, I mean, psychology is one of the major topics of Srimad Bhagavatam. The problem is that we miss it. We don't know where it is, although it's right there in front of us. And we're going to point out where it is and go into it very, very deeply. So as I said, when it comes to philosophy, tattva, the gloves go off in this class. But now we're giving a nice introduction so that you all feel comfortable with where we're going. But once we get to where we're going, it's going to be very, very deep, profound philosophy. So, I think we can just go to the point that our dear Nitai Gauranga wanted to make about quantum physics and its relationship to mental phenomena. So first, please introduce yourself.
Hello, my name is Nitai Gauranga Das, and I guess I could tell the story how I ended up with Maharaj doing this course. Was one day, because I studied psychology, I have a bachelor's in psychology, and I'm going to go on to graduate school. And so I knew Maharaj was interested in psychology, and so I just wanted to see if he had any interesting ideas. And so I just posed a couple questions to him. We had a good conversation. And I think it was that same night that I was home fast asleep, and Maharaj came, and my roommate let him in, and he just walked right into my room and woke me up and told me that he had this great idea that while the Bhagavatam lecture is breaking, that we can have this class on psychology. And I was very enthusiastic, and since then he has given me a vast amount of books, which I've been plowing through. And
by the way, I just want to interrupt you and just say that what he just described of my behavior is a good example of what's called obsessive compulsive behavior. I am a very obsessive compulsive type of person. I get an idea, I have to act on it. Okay.
So since then I've been reading numerous books on Vedic psychology and Indian psychology, and then going back to Western psychology and going back and forth and getting a lot of interesting ideas. But so I have a bachelor's degree in psychology, and I graduated a little more than a year ago. And since then, my last semester in school, and then for a year after that, I was working in a psychiatric hospital, mostly with adolescents. Was my focus, but every now and then I would work with adults, and originally I worked with adults. And especially working with adults was interesting. I have a lot of experience that lends itself to this discussion, because I would say about half of the adults that get admitted into inpatient psychiatric facilities are experiencing some form of psychosis, which means there's a break with reality. Namely, there is either hallucinations, means there is a visual or a sensual perception that has no basis with reality. So hallucinations, hearing voices, seeing things, seeing people, etc. Or delusions, which means false thoughts. So it's funny, even though it's a cliche, it's quite often that you find people that they feel that the government is after them. It's not only in movies, it really does happen. People do think that quite often. And I don't know, maybe it's true. Maybe that's why.
What about the aliens?
Oh, yeah, some aliens too. So I've had a lot of interesting experiences, which is augmented and given me a deeper understanding of the things that I learned while I was in school. So I guess within this course, I'd like to talk mostly about, I guess the majority of it will be the science of perception, which falls under the category of psychology, which I didn't focus on that in school, but I did take some courses in it, and it was quite fascinating. And I think the ultimate conclusion of perception is that we don't have direct contact with the world around us, and that our representation of the world is at best subjective, perhaps, you know, at times entirely false. But really, in the end, we can't trust our sense perception. It isn't an accurate way to understand the world, which is interesting in light of Vaishnava theology. So, I feel silly. The thing I wanted to talk about today isn't my field, but it lends itself to that field, and that's quantum psychology, quantum
physics.
That's the name of a book, quantum physics. But it was the book that the ideas came from a more of a linguist than a physicist. So the ideas are in layman's terms, so not too difficult to comprehend. But his name was Owen Barfield. He was a good friend of, I don't know if people know C.S. Lewis. He's a Christian theologian and apologist, and J.R.R. Tolkien, that everyone probably knows because Lord of the Rings movies were popular, and you know, before that, if you had no friends and just read silly books, then you know you knew him from that too. But he was a contemporary and good friend of them, and he wrote a book called the title of this book is so clever and catchy. Do you remember it, Maharaj? The name of that book?
Which book you're referring to?
The one, the idolatry. Oh, Saving the Appearances, A Study in Idolatry. And he begins this book posing a question of what is real and what actually exists. And so he gives the example of a tree and a rainbow. And so he asks, does the rainbow really exist in the same way that the tree does? So rainbow, you know, we see always far off in the distance, but everyone has the experience of the rainbow. We can get a group of people together and say, hey, you see that? And they'll say, yeah, I see that. That's really neat. But you can't touch the rainbow. You can't get close to the rainbow. The more you chase after it, the farther it goes away, then it'll eventually just leave in general. We can say in that sense that the rainbow is real and that we can see it. We all have a perception of it. But maybe not quite as real as a tree is real. A tree, we can go up, we can touch it, we can smell it, we can maybe pick off a fruit of it and eat it, we can kick it, we can bang our head against it. It's real in the realest sense of what real is as far as we know. So, he makes an interesting argument that just as the rainbow is composed of rain or moisture and light, and then us observing it, us having our eyes open to it, in the same way that the tree is composed of particles and light hitting it and bouncing off of it into our eyes and us perceiving it. According to Vedic psychology, this is an interesting idea. I can't remember the Sanskrit terms, but there's three aspects to perception. There is the physics of something, that something exists in the world. It has physical properties. It is real. The second characteristic is the physiology, that we have the ability, the perceptual apparatus to perceive it. So, for example, there is some green plants there. I have eyes that are... So the green plant is the physics.
Adiabatic and adiatmic is the eye.
Oh, yeah.
Adiabatic is the thing, adiatmic.
Yeah. Yes. So there's the physics of the plant, the physiology of my eye, and the third aspect is the psychology, the fact that I have... I'm conscious of it, I'm participating in the observation. I notice it, I want to notice it, I'm not blocking it out, I see it. So these three aspects of perception are all there, therefore I perceive the plant. But he wants to make the argument, Barfield wants to make the argument that the particles of the tree, or in this case the particles of the plant, the substances that make up the plant, can be akin to the raindrops of the rainbow, that actually... They're of the same substance. And because this isn't my field, I will just directly read a paragraph out of this book, which is terribly interesting. And yet we also know that the very material of which the tree is made is itself made of other things, of molecules, which are made of atoms, which are made of subatomic particles, which are made of even smaller elementary particles, which themselves are made up of, well, something that is increasingly difficult to describe using the idea of a thing. Charges of energy, probability fluctuations, quarks, leptons, and a host of other increasingly arcane entities, some of which are said to exist only for the most inconceivable fraction of time, while others are said to move from future to past and not, as most of us do, the other way around. The world of elementary particles is, science tells us, what is really, really there. The most accurate way of expressing how modern physics, meaning the new physics, beginning with Einstein in quantum theory, sees the world is to say that the only really real things are mathematical equations. The old model of an atom with a nucleus around which orbit electrons, a kind of miniature solar system, has been obsolete for decades, as has the idea of trying to model the behavior of these mysterious non-things. Today, models and metaphors are used mostly to convey some idea of the discoveries to physicists, to laymen. And most models and metaphors are misleading. When popular science writers talk of atoms as the building blocks of the universe, they are perpetuating a misconception. The universe is built of no thing, except perhaps for mathematical formulae, something the ancient philosopher Pythagoras suggested a millennia ago. But then, how do we get to a tree? When I see it, I do not see electrons buzzing or elementary particles making prodigious quantum leaps. What I do see is a tall, stout, multi-limbed, leaf-bearing growth of a general green, gray, and brownish color, and so do you. So how is this so? Barfield makes the analogy that particles are to a tree as everything else as well as raindrops are to a rainbow. And just as rainbows are really there because we see them, so are trees really there because we see them. And then he goes on to make this point that what we're seeing is a representation of energy. That our experience of something being hard or being soft, being close, being far away, is a representation of energy. It's part of the... It's our psychological disposition towards something that creates it, actually. That there is objective matter out there, for sure. There is something, but through our perceptual senses, we don't know what it is exactly, but we do know that it's something, and our seeing of a tree, or of a plant, or of this building, is our way to interface with something that is much more complex than that. That is the energy, the building blocks, the things that are really, really there. And again, if one aspect of, this is the interesting part, if one aspect of perception is missing, then there is nothing to perceive and no object actually exists. So in this case, when we say that, okay, there's this building that we're under right now, if there is no conscious observer to observe it, if there is no one here to observe this building is nothing but energy, because this building is a how we see and understand this building is a representation of that energy, our representation. And so if we're not there to represent it in our minds, then the building is actually simply energy and nothing more. Anyway, is that terribly complex, or do we have any questions on that? Because
I'd like to make... a comment too, just, and I think these are like summary comments. One thing that comes out of this is that everything we're experiencing is actually mental phenomena. Mm-hmm. The senses simply being the portals of the mind to, as he explained, something that's out there that we really don't know. We really don't know what it is. So the senses are portals of the mind too, that X out there. And what we're experiencing is all within the mind. You see? Everything we're experiencing, this world, is all formed inside our minds. So, we're all living inside of our own heads, as the expression is. But from this we should not come to the conclusion. There's a philosophy called solipsism, which the conclusion is, I'm the only conscious entity in existence, and you're, the rest of you are just my imagination. Because actually, we are all talking about the same things. We'll all agree that we can all count the same number of pillars here. We'll all see the same, talk about the same greenery over there. You see, there's a shared experience at the same time, which indicates that there is an objective reality. But whatever it is, you see, we're only getting some... the film will show this very clearly. An indirect impression of it in the mind. This mental picture that we have, logically speaking, this is what Barfield is saying, may have absolutely no resemblance at all to what's really out there. We don't know. And the second point I wanted to make, and this is made in that book too, is that this is a very excellent argument against the theory of evolution. You know, when you see those nice books that show dinosaurs, and then before the dinosaurs there were those amphibious creatures crawling out of the ocean, and then those big bony-headed fish, you know, 18 feet long before them, and with only two big teeth, and then finally they say the earth was just a bubbling ocean of, you know, steaming ocean of chemicals, and before that it was a fiery ball flung off the sun. They tell you that with such confidence. But the problem in all this, and they even show you pictures that they draw. They have these artists. I remember when I was a kid, I used to look at these books, and there was, I forgot the name of the artist, but he was very famous for drawing dinosaurs. And really elaborate, very elaborate paintings of dinosaurs. And the problem here is that this is all from the human perspective. But according to evolution, there were no human beings then. So things could not have looked that way. They could not have looked as those pictures show. All that was there, if as they say, there was no consciousness, then there was just energy. There was just energy. And you can't talk about a ball of, fire being thrown off the sun and then bubbling chemical soup and things coming to... You can't talk about that. All you can say is that there's just some formless energies. That's all you can say was there. In reality, that's the logical conclusion of what we just heard. So this totally, you see, in this way, science totally undermines itself. And the whole world, that's why Prabhupada was so, he once said, my mission is to kick the scientists in the face with a boot. Because everything they say is so fraught with contradiction. They talk on one side so confidently about, you know, their evolutionary theory, but on the other side, the quantum physics totally disproves it. Totally disproves, you know, all these, you know, the theory of the prehistoric ages and so on and so forth, and the evolution of creatures. So, yes?
I have a question.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
If all the material universe is just like a manifestation of our mind, what about the spiritual world, or not necessarily the spiritual world, but the demigods, or even like...
Well, let's clarify what we're saying. We're not saying that all the material in the universe is simply in the mind. We're saying our experience is only in the mind. Yes.
The interpretation of the material world
is
by the mind.
Yes.
And when the sages like cognize the visual aspect of the demigods like Shiva and Saraswati, so
they were in a state called Turiya, which is beyond the mind.
So it depends on their interpretation.
No. I'm saying that the great sages who gave us the Vedas were on a platform called Turiya, the fourth stage beyond the modes of nature. At best, the mind is in the mode of goodness, the material mind. But by yoga, bhakti yoga, Krishna consciousness, one goes beyond this material mind into the realm of transcendence. That is the realm of reality. That's the realm of the Lord's mind.
So this means that once you are at that stage of consciousness, they all perceive in the same way all this world.
Yeah, you perceive, as Prabhupada said, you know what Krishna wants you to know. You can't know everything, but what Krishna wants you to know in His, you know, as His pure servant, you will know. Prabhupada used to say that about Himself. It is not that I know everything, but I know what Krishna wants me to know. And that was an awful lot. He knew more than anyone else in this world. So, on this interesting note, we want to take you upstairs to our little theater and show you a film that will very, very wonderful way illustrate these points we've just been making about the mystery of perception.
Warning. The subject of this film you are about to watch reveals a crucial secret of your life. You should watch it very attentively, for it concerns a subject that is liable to make fundamental changes in your outlook on the material world. The content of this film is not just a different approach or a philosophical thought. It is a fact which is also proven by science today.
This movie wasn't made by Hare Krishna, by the way. This is just
man is conditioned right from the beginning of his life that the world he lives in has an absolute material reality. So he grows up under the effect of this conditioning and builds his entire life on this viewpoint. The findings of modern science, however, have revealed a completely different and significant reality than what is presumed. All the information that we have about the external world is conveyed to us by our five senses. The world we know of consists of what our eyes see, our ears hear, our noses smell, our tongues taste, and our hands feel. Man is dependent on only those five senses since birth. That is why he knows the external world only the way it is presented by these senses. Yet, scientific research carried out on our senses has revealed very different facts about what we call external world. And these facts have brought to light a very important secret about matter, which makes up the external world. Contemporary thinker Frederick Bester explains the point that science has reached on this subject. Statements of some scientists posing that man is an image, everything experienced is temporary and deceptive, and this universe is a shadow, seems to be proven by science in our day. In order to better grasp this secret behind matter, let us be reminded of our information about our sense of sight, which provides us with the most extensive information about the external world. act of seeing is realized progressively. At the instance of seeing, light clusters called photons travel from the object to the eye and pass through the eye lens, where they are refracted and focus on the retina at the back of the eye. Here, rays are turned into electrical signals and then transmitted by neurons to the center of vision at the back of the brain. The act of seeing actually takes place in this center in the brain. All the images we view in our lives and all the events we experience are actually experienced in this tiny and dark place. Both the film you are now watching and the boundless landscape you see when you gaze at the horizon actually fit into this place of a few cubic centimeters. Now, let us reconsider this information more carefully. When we say we see, we actually see the effect the rays reaching our eyes form in our brain by being converted into electric signals. When we say we see, we actually observe the electrical signals in our brain. By the way, there is another point that has to be kept in mind. The brain is sealed to light, and its interior is absolutely dark. Therefore, it is never possible for the brain to contact with light itself. We can explain this interesting situation with an example. Let us suppose that in front of us there is a burning candle and we view its light. During this period, when we view the candle's light, the inside of our skull and our brain are in absolute darkness. The light of the candle never illuminates our brain and our center of vision. However, we watch a colorful and bright world inside our dark brain. The same situation applies to all our other senses. Sound, touch, taste, and smell are all perceived in the brain as electrical signals. Therefore, our brains throughout our lives do not confront the original of the matter existing outside us, but rather an electrical copy of it formed inside our brain. It is at this point that we are misled by assuming these copies are instances of real matter outside us. These physical facts make us come to an indisputable conclusion. Everything we see, touch, hear, and perceive is matter. The world, or the universe, is only electrical signals in our brain. For instance, we see a bird in the external world. In reality, this bird is not in the external world, but in our brain. The light particles reflecting from the bird reach our eye, and there they are converted into electrical signals. These signals are transmitted by neurons to the center of vision in the brain. The bird we see is, in fact, the electric signals in our brain. If the sight nerves traveling to the brain were disconnected, the image of the bird would suddenly disappear. In the same manner, the bird sounds we hear are also in our brain. If the nerve traveling from the ear to the brain was disconnected, there would be no sound left. Put simply, the bird, the shape of which we see, and the sound of which we hear, is nothing but the brain's interpretation of electrical signals. Another point to be considered here is the sense of distance. For example, the distance between you and this screen is nothing but a feeling of space formed in your brain. Also, objects that seem to be very distant in one person's view are actually images clustered at one spot in the brain. For instance, someone who watches the stars in the sky assumes that they are millions of light years away from him. Yet the stars are right inside himself and the center of vision of his brain. While you watch this film, you are in truth not inside the room you assume yourself to be in. On the contrary, the room is inside you. Your seeing your body makes you think that you are inside of it. However, you must remember that your body too is an image formed inside your brain. So far, we have been speaking repeatedly of an external world and a world of perceptions formed in our brain, the latter of which is what we see. However, since we can never actually reach the external world, how can we be sure that such a world really exists? Definitely we cannot. The only reality we cope with is the world of perceptions we live within our minds. We believe in the existence of objects just because we see and touch them, and they are reflected to us by our perceptions. However, our perceptions are only ideas in our mind. Thus, objects we captivate by perceptions are nothing but ideas, and these ideas are essentially in nowhere but our mind. Since all these exist only in the mind, then it means that we are beguiled by deceptions when we imagine the universe and things to have an existence outside the mind. To imagine matter to have an existence outside the mind is indeed a deception. The perceptions we observe may well be coming from an artificial source. It is possible to see this in the mind's eye by an example. First, let us suppose that we could take our brain out of our body and keep it alive in a glass jar. Let us put a computer in which all kinds of information can be recorded. Finally, let us transmit the electrical signals of all the data related to a setting, such as image, sound, and smell, to this computer. Let us connect this computer to the sensory centers in our brain with electrodes and send the pre-recorded data to our brain. As our brain perceives these signals, it will see and live the setting correlated with these. From this computer, we can send to our brain also signals pertaining to our own image. For instance, we can send to our brain the electrical correlates of such senses as sight, hearing, and touch that we perceive while we sit at a desk. In that state, our brain would think itself as a businessman sitting in his office. This imaginary world would continue as long as the stimulations keep coming from the computer. We would never realize that we only consist of a brain. It is indeed very easy for us to be deceived into believing perceptions without any material correlates to be real. This is just what happens in our dreams. Thank you. for you. Reality is all that can be touched with the hand and seen with the eye. In your dreams, you can also touch with your hand and see with your eye. But in reality, you have neither hand nor eye, nor is there anything that can be touched or seen. Taking what you perceive in your dream to be material realities, you are simply deceived. For example, a person deeply asleep in his bed may see himself in an entirely different world in his dream. He may dream that he is a pilot and command a giant airplane, and even spend a great effort to command the plane. In fact, this person has not taken even one step away from his bed. In his dreams, he may visit different settings and meet with friends, have a chat with them, eat and drink together. It is only when the person awakes from his dream that he realizes all were only perceptions. If we are able to live easily in an unreal world during our dreams, the same thing can equally be true for the world we live in. When we wake up from a dream, there is no logical reason for not thinking that we have entered a longer dream that we call real life. The reason we consider our dream to be fancy and the world is real is nothing but a product of our habits and prejudices. This suggests that we may well be awoken from the life on earth, which we think we are living right now, just as we are awoken from a dream. After all these physical facts, arises the question of primary importance. If all physical events that we know are intrinsically perceptions, what about our brain? Since our brain is a matter just like our arms, legs, or any other object, it also must be a perception just like all other objects. An example will illuminate the subject further. Let us think that we extend the nerves reaching our brain and put it outside our head, where we can see it with our eyes. In this case, we would be able to see also our brain and touch it with our fingers. This way, we can understand that our brain is also nothing but a perception formed by the senses of vision and touch. Then, what is the will that sees, hears and perceives all other senses if it is not the brain? Who is it that sees, hears, touches, and perceives the taste and smell? Who is this being that thinks, reasons, has feelings, and moreover that says, "I am me"? One of the important thinkers of our age, Carl Prebram, also poses the same question. Since the Greeks, philosophers have been thinking about the ghost in the machine, the small man within the small man, etc. Where is I, the person who uses his brain? Who is it that realizes the act of knowing? As St. Francis of Assisi said, what we search for is the one that sees. In fact, this metaphysical being that uses the brain, that sees and feels, is the soul. What we call the material world is the aggregate of perceptions viewed and felt by this soul. Just as the bodies we possess and the material world we see in our dreams have no physical reality, the universe we occupy and the bodies we possess now also have no physical reality. The real absolute being is the soul. Matter consists merely of perceptions viewed by the soul. Yes, even if we start with the presupposition that matter is real, the laws of physics, chemistry, and biology all lead us to the fact that matter consists of an illusion, and to the inevitable actuality of a metaphysical matter. This is the secret beyond matter. This fact is so definite that it alarms some materialist scientists who think matter to be the absolute being. Science writer Lincoln Barnett says in his book, The Universe and Einstein, along with philosophers' reduction of all objective reality to a shadow world of perceptions, scientists have become aware of the alarming limitations of man's senses. All these facts bring us face to face with a very significant question. If the thing we acknowledge to be the material world is merely comprised of perceptions given to our soul, then what is the source of these perceptions? In answering this question, we must consider the fact that matter does not have a self-governing existence by itself, but is a perception. Therefore, this perception must have been caused by another power, which means that it must have been created. Moreover, this creation must be continuous. If there were not a continuous and consistent creation, then what we call matter would disappear and be lost. This may be likened to a television on which a picture is displayed as long as the signal continues to be broadcast. If the broadcast stops, the image on the screen will also disappear. So, who makes our soul see the earth, people, plants, our bodies, and all else that we see? It is very evident that there is a superior creator who has created the entire material universe. That is the sum of all perceptions and continues his creation ceaselessly. Since this creator displays such a magnificent creation, he surely has eternal power and might. All the perceptions he creates are dependent on his will, and he dominates everything he has created at any moment. This creator is Allah, the Lord of the heavens and the earth. The only real absolute being is Allah. All things except him are shadow beings he created. This reality is explained by the great Islamic scholar, Imam Rabbani, as follows. Allah, the substance of these beings which he created, is but nothingness. He created all in the sphere of senses and illusions. The existence of the universe is in the sphere of senses and illusions, and it is not material. In reality, there is nothing in the outside except the glorious being who is Allah. In all the four corners of this universe that is made up of perceptions is Allah's being as the only real being. Therefore, the closest being to man is Allah. This fact is explained in the Quran with the verse, "We created man, and we are nearer to him than his jugular vein." Wherever we are, Allah is with us. While you watch this film, the closest being to you is Allah, who creates everything you see at any moment. As long as Allah makes us see images and gives sensations related to this world, we continue to live in this world. When he ends the images and sensations belonging to this world, shows us the angels of death, and gives perceptions of a different dimension, this means we have died. the day of resurrection, judgment, heaven, hell, and all our eternal life will be created in the same way for us. To create all these is too easy for Allah, who displays the evidence of His eternal power and infinite knowledge to us, yet in this world.
Remember that in Sanskrit, Prahlada means the supreme bliss.
Prahlada.
Yeah. So, can you turn on the light?
No. So I hope you enjoyed the film. And I just want to do, before you leave, what we call a commercial. We have, as an adjunct to this course, there is over there, if you come here in the day, you can see we've set up a special, we call it a Chakra Tirtha. And we're offering to do what we call Jnana Yajna. It takes the form similar to a fire sacrifice, but it is actually symbolic with mantras and yantras. It is all coming from Panchatra. And this is a teaching tool. It looks, well, it is intended actually to be extremely mystical, to evoke, to open doors of perception other than just logic and reason. But here, the Vidyapeeth, the school here, we're just using it as a visual teaching tool, and any mystical perceptions that you might get out of it, that's between you and Sudarshan, because this is the Sudarshan Jnana Yajna. We're using the Sudarshan Yantra. And what this will do is illustrate for you in a very short time very, very much tattva, very much philosophy. The same philosophy that we're just discussing here, just like we saw in the film about the where we go in dreams, that the mind is going to different places in dreams. So in the Sudarshan Yantra, the eight cities of dreams are laid out, and you can find out what they are. And you may be able to find out what your own personal favorite city of dream is, where you like to go most in the night. So all of these kind of things. But this is a service that we offer. As I said, this is commercial. And so there is a minimum donation required. And the donation goes entirely to the Vidyapeeth. It doesn't go into anyone's pocket. It goes into the treasury of the school. We ask $21 or 1,000 Indian rupees. For this, it will take 1-2 hours to do. It will require your concentration, attention. You will be asked to focus in meditation on different things and to chant bija mantras and to do things with cards, with Bhagavad Gita verses, placing them on the yantras. And it's a very elaborate and multi-dimensional type of again symbolical sacrifice, which has meanings on the level of dravya, your physical existence, kriya, your activities, jnana, your mind, and also on the ultimate level of bhakti. So those who are interested may find out more about that. We have this introduction. It's here it is.
what the Mahasudarshan Chakra Jnana Yajna is and what it isn't. So what not to expect from it. You're not going to get good luck. It's not astrology. We're not going to be talking about past lives, future lives. It's not going to make your household or life any better. You're not going to have a good son as a result. It's not tantra. It's not anything like this. This is a Jnana Yajna. It is meant simply to give you knowledge. And by knowledge you achieve shanti. Therefore it's a type of yajna is also called a shanti karma. It's simply meant to bring peace to the mind through knowledge. So if you're really interested, we have only 10 copies. So if you're really interested, I'm not going to give this to someone who just wants to take it and read it and that's interesting when you put it. But if you're really interested in knowing about this, then we do have 10 copies.
Yes.
Then you may take and read. And after reading, the next step is that we have a little examination. You have an example of that?
I do.
It's here. Oh, this second thing, yes. There's a small examination. These are very simple questions. But as you can see, they involve diagrams and symbols, so they work on a level of consciousness. In other words, you can't fool me. I'll be able to know what's going on in your mind when you complete these very simple questions. And judging on how you've answered that, then we'll have a talk and see if it is appropriate for you to participate in this. Because this is definitely not for everybody, nor is it public. You can't bring your friends to, you know, have a look and videotape it. You can bring your own tape recorder and tape the session yourself, audio tape it. But it is not a public thing. It is just for those who are want to go very, very deeply, very, very swiftly into the depths of this subject matter of mind, perception, and actually the nature of the universe, the form of the universe, subtle and gross, because the Sudarshan Chakra is actually the form of the universe. Very interesting. The yantra depicts the entire universe. So they want to build a Vedic planetarium. I always tell them, it's not a very difficult thing. Just enter into the science of sound and the corresponding yantras that come out of the sound, and that's the form of the universe. So because there is no Vedic planetarium, this is our what we have to offer at this school. Our little school here is so we can bring you into the Vedic conception of the universe through Sudarshan. Remember that Sudarshan means the vision of the Lord. And Bhagavatam 4th Canto says, Krishna consciousness means to see the universe exactly as the Lord sees it. So, as this film also said, because Allah, Krishna, God is looking at everything, therefore everything exists. And so, we hope by this Jnana Yajna to bring you into more direct awareness of this fact. It is not simply operating on the level of logic and explanation, as the class is. But this is more of an experience. A mystical experience, if I may use that word. So as I said, if you are actually, if this really interests you in a serious way, then we would be glad to give you a copy of the introduction. And then you can decide if you'd like to take the test and proceed with the process. Alright, so that's it for this evening, and we hope that you have become intrigued enough to want to come tomorrow. We can continue at 4 o'clock. Maybe you can bring a friend and the class will get bigger. That's even nicer. Thank you very much. And as anyone who's interested in this, you can stay and we can talk a little bit. So good evening, Hare Krishna.
Thank you very much.